Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's August 26th, 2018, and welcome to episode 178 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and collecting, and collecting, and collecting, and more collecting. Hi, I'm Michael Mulhern, I'm your host for today's episode. With me from various parts of the globe, we have other roundtablers. Hiding somewhere up in the Boston area is Paul Hagstrom. How are you this morning, Paul?
I'm fine this morning.
Oh, that's right. This world, it's a sphere thing, isn't it?
Yeah,
so it's not morning everywhere.
Oh. So it's starting to cool down from summer here, and I imagine it's sort of doing the reverse for you.
Yeah, oh, well, we've actually got some of the first rain that we've had for a long time. The entire state was declared in drought. So, yeah, it's good to get a little bit of rain. It's not going to break the drought where it's needed, but... It's certainly welcome here at our place. Yes, it's a shock. With the lack of rain, there haven't been many wallabies in my backyard.
Also very few in mine. I'm not sure if it's rain-related.
Yeah, so you can't mark wallaby off on your RCR bingo card, folks.
Right.
Over on the other side of your wee little island, we have Earl. Earl, how are you today?
Hey there, Michael. Good morning, afternoon, evening. I'm doing pretty well, thank you. And I'll comment on the weather as we're wont to do, because we've had lots and lots of days of sunny and in the 90s in those American Fahrenheit-y things, which I think in Celsius is like 500 or something like that. And
thereabouts.
And finally, it's cooled down, and we've got a few clouds, and the temperature is a little bit more livable. So I'm actually pretty happy about that.
So wouldn't that be your entire year's quota of fine days?
It might be. Yeah, I mean, they say, when is summer in Portland? And I tell people, well, last year it was on a Thursday. But actually, we do have a lot of sunny and hot days during the summer. We don't advertise it because then everybody will come here. But we also have 9 months of not that. So you take what you get.
Yeah. And lurking on the other side of this sphere for me is Jack. How are you today, Jack?
Pretty good, Michael. Continue the weather theme. Sweden is devolving into its typical fall, sort of rainy, not that warm. It's not cold. Okay, it's not cold, but it's kind of rainy. But it's all right. Ah, we've had a really hot summer. I can't complain. It's all good.
Yes, well, summer is something I've got to look forward to.
Yep, you're ahead of us.
One of the reasons I've installed some air conditioning downstairs here in the bunker.
Oh, very nice.
Nice.
Yes. Oh, well, that's the main reason is winter, because it gets bitterly cold down in here, you know, carved into the sandstone and all of that, but also to help with dehumidifying, because although we may be in a drought here in New South Wales, we still get plenty of water seeping through the sandstone into the drains. Yes, it'll be a long time before... in behind the bunker is dry, but yeah. Well, folks, let's move on to host topic. I thought that we'd look at the something that's near and dear to all of us. Are you a museum, a private collector, or just a hoarder? Now, this sort of came back up into my fore with the trials and tribulations of the Australian Computer Museum Society, who had until recently, as in the 10th of August, to vacate their current Sydney Villawood warehouse, where they had about 200 square metres, which I'm not quite sure what works out into, but yeah, let's just call that over 250 square yards of warehouse storage of old computers, monitors, bits and pieces, and whoever who knows how much boxes of documentation. And they had that till the 10th of August to get it out, otherwise the building was coming down. Well, there was no otherwise about it. There was all these hoardings around the building site showing these wonderful new apartments that were going to be built on that site. But the first thing they had to do was to vacate the businesses that were upstairs and the computer museum's warehouse store downstairs. So it was a bit of a surprise. Well, mid-July, I decided I'd go to the Society's annual general meeting. I've always toyed with the idea of getting involved in it, in the museum, Computer Museum Society, and offering what assistance I could, and a few other like-minded younger individuals also. So we turned up, and it was almost as if in the general business of the meeting it was, oh, and we have to vacate the Villawood warehouse because it's coming down to make a block of apartments. And yeah, I was a little bit taken aback. So we only had a little bit of time for us new guys to sort of wrap our minds around that and get in there and help. So I made several trips. I'm currently looking after a few bits and pieces. They put a call out for other people to help. I sadly think that some of the people may have gone and padded out their own private collections, but we will track you down. Actually, I'm just happy that the stuff is out. We'll worry about where it's currently being stored later on. I'm just happy that it hasn't become part of some landfill delivered by the truckload after the wrecking balls come in. But yeah, I was there, helped finish packing a 40-foot container with bits and pieces. As I said, I've made several car trips there because I worked down that way. I was able to detour on my way home, fill the little car up with a few bits and pieces. So, you know, I got a few things. The most interesting one that I'm going to just check out a little bit more closely is an Eclipse System 140. Bit old, bit dusty. I'm going to find out what it was used for. So guys, with the Australian Computer Museum's collection now somewhat safer in, I think, three containers and various other spots waiting for us to locate some alternate storage, because you can't keep stuff in containers forever. What are your thoughts? Do you consider yourself a museum, which I keep putting air quotes around that, just a private collector or a hoarder? I'm somewhere between the private collector and the hoarder myself. I'm just wondering where do some of your other collections fit in? So
are these supposed to be like actual labels or aspirational labels?
Oh, I don't know. I think I might be more of a hoarder aspiring to be a private collector, or maybe I'm a private collector that has lost his aspiration and descended into hoarderness. So... Earl, you teased us with some thoughts. What have you got to say about this?
Well, I don't think I'm a museum because there's a couple different ways I think that you could view the term museum. There's some, I think, official definitions around museum that if you talk to people that are in the museum world, in the museum community, they would tell you that there are certain thresholds and rules and that kind of thing that you need to adhere to if you want to be a museum. And I don't care about any of that because I'm not in the museum world. But to me, a museum at least needs to be a resource that is in some way serving or open to the public. That'd be my definition of it. And I'm not. You know, I don't invite random strangers to come to my house and see my collection. Not that that would be a bad thing, but it's just not what I do. So I don't think in any way I could be characterized as a museum. I think even you could be a museum if, like I've seen some collectors do, you had really nice pages of information about your collection up on the internet. Pictures and other information, maybe some provenance of the items that you have. Where did they come from? How were they used in the past? If you happen to know that kind of stuff. I don't even do that. So I'm not a museum. Definitely not a museum. Now, private collection versus hoarder, that depends on who you talk to. I'm a private collector. My wife, I don't know if she sees it that way. So I'm trying not to be a hoarder, though, and to that end, I have actually been and continuing to be in the process of thinning out some of my collection, either giving or selling pieces of it to various parties so that I can focus on the things that I like. But, you know, I think part of also, and I don't want to steal all the thunder here, but part of the difference between a private collector and a hoarder, I think, is does it give you stress? When you look at your pile of computer stuff, do you feel like, wow, that's pretty neat, I can't wait to play with that? Or do you look at it and go, oh my gosh, where am I going to put all this stuff? I'm so stressed out. I'm just going to curl up in a fetal position now. And I think I don't want to be the latter of that particular scenario. So starting to thin things out, maybe a little bit of a hoarder, trying to be a private collector, but am unlikely to ever be a museum, as nice as that would be.
So basically having everything pushed onto shelves in your garage and having your mates come over every now and again doesn't quite make you a museum then.
Okay. No, I think that might. I think that might. If you were part of, like you were mentioning, that you jumped into a group of people that are interested in retro collecting, and if you had a space like your garage where you could set some things up and invite some people over, that sort of thing, I think you're on your way to being a museum at that point. I think that qualifies.
Yeah. Well, I must admit, it's certainly meant that I've been doing a few things that I haven't never contemplated, like going out and looking at, I'll call it shop fronts, showroom type areas with warehouse attached, purely for that there, to try and find a site that's affordable, accessible, and usable. Because I think the first step that you need to have is to have somewhere that not only do you have things on display, but that people can safely move around and see them, and in I would hope a lot of cases actually get up close to them. I'm not a great fan of things behind glass or in roped off areas, except maybe for the rarer types of things. But I definitely like the museums that I've gone to that have hands-on displays, or at least displays that you can get up close to. That's something that I like to look at. A museum's got to have that interactivity, and I suppose, as you were saying, if you can get that online, maybe that's sort of leading towards an online presence, or even just a purely online museum. Let's see. Jack, are you a private collector or are you a hoarder?
I am definitely on the private collector end of things. And that is because I fight my hoarding instincts as hard as I possibly can. Like,
three cheers for Jack.
If I were to just let myself go and get everything I wanted to get, I would definitely be called a hoarder by any sensible person. But I actually do not collect a lot of stuff. It's actually pretty small and these days pretty well organized, but nowhere near museum quality. Like, not even a small museum exhibit. Like Earl said, I don't have like anything of like the provenance of anything. And a lot of what I have is sort of bits and pieces. I don't have things that look nice on a display or anything like that. So it's definitely not museum, definitely not hoarder. Private collector on a pretty small scale, actually, compared to you guys, I know, pretty quite small scale.
Okay, so we won't be coming over to the Nutting Museum anytime soon.
I'm afraid not.
Okay. Oh, well. Well, saving the best till last. I wonder who we could be talking to now. Well. So, Paul, sitting there beside your potential avalanche of historical computing devices, that what would you consider yourself and what would be your take on museum, private collector, or hoarder?
Yeah, so I know that I have always, you know, from when I had nothing sort of assembled here throughout, I kind of thought like my goal was to save things, document things, you know, sort of like, and, you know, in particular, maybe get a chance to kind of like see how things worked and take videos of them working and that kind of thing. And I didn't really intend to keep, you know, to have all of these things. But the problem is that the time to the documenting time hasn't shown up yet. So I am at this point kind of surrounded by many things. And I don't think I ever intend to have any kind of museum. I would actually like to, once I actually have gotten through and scanned and photographed and imaged and videoed everything that I then don't keep, I would kind of like to have a sort of a nice little display of important machines from the early computing or whatever that work in my office space. But even that wouldn't really be a museum. It would just be something that like people who happen to be in my office could see. And, you know, maybe I could turn on the Lisa and say, like, you know, look, this is the thing that came before your Mac. And if you wait 10 more minutes, it'll actually reach the desktop. But
So it's only marginally slower than a modern computer. Right. Okay.
The Apple II, man, you turn it on. Or the VIC-20 or whatever, oh. You know, it's like right there.
Yeah. No, that's my favorite spot. Grab the computer, turn it on, do something. None of this booting up and logging in stuff.
Right, exactly. But yeah, I mean, I guess, so from the outside, I think I am indistinguishable from a hoarder, but I don't believe that I am one because my intent is to get rid of all of these things, but I just need to, I need to capture them first.
So this is really an existential question,
yeah.
Then, what you're saying, Paul. It's okay. Okay.
But, so, yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, I enjoy having, being able to experience the, you know, sort of unusual items, you know, that I have some, like, I have a Lisa, and that's cool, and, you know, and I know that a lot of people don't have that opportunity to play with them. Although, actually, there was on the, now tangenting wildly, there's a Lisa group, like a Facebook group, and at one point somebody asked the question of like, you know, how many Lisas, you know, who has an actual Lisa here, and I was actually surprised to see how many of them there were. I mean, many people have many of them, so they're still kind of hard to get a hold of, but they're not quite at risk of disappearing from the planet. Anyway, yeah, I don't know. I don't know where I ended up on that, but I think to be a real museum of any note, you know, I'm not really interested in running such a thing. I am interested in the web idea, though. I mean, like, that's part of the point of the documentation, would be to make it accessible to the world, so people who don't have this, like, you know, one weird thing that 10 of them were made, you know, can still sort of experience it that way. So that's my aspirational hope. I don't know how long it's going to take me to get there. I have to stop getting things and start, you know, going the other direction.
seems we all have this affliction at one level or another. But yeah, that's one of the things that's come out of this for me is that I and a couple of others, we're sort of looking at what makes it a museum. What do we need to do? Even if it's just for what we need to get in place to start applying for grants and also looking for the sponsorship for along those lines, because that, you know, there is tucked away in that dusty pile of equipment some very nice bits and pieces, and I really would like to see it somewhere that has a more of a focus just on computing, because it's one thing I feel that we are lacking here in Australia, or Sydney especially, is a museum facility that has a focus on computing. We have other museums, institutions that occasionally have displays or exhibits of older computers, history of gaming and things like that, but it's not a permanent display. So you get to go and see a temporary display, and when I mean temporary, it's there for 6 months or something like that, and then the bits and pieces disappear back into their storage, and then it's replaced with some totally different aspect of Australian history or a overseas exhibit being put on display. It's not something that has a persistence to do with computing, and I think that's what's needed. But now, then the other thing is that sort of like, how much interest is there? So it's an interesting world, and we'll see where I get with it, and see if any good habits rub off onto my hoard / private collection here in the bunker.
Oh, good luck.
Yeah, that would be really neat, Michael. And you know, one of the things that you said resonates with me a lot, that if you have to choose between the under the glass, inaccessible type of museum versus the I can walk up and touch it and get a little bit of a feel of vintage computing interactively, I'm definitely, you know, leaning more towards the interactive bit. For instance, we talk about it frequently, but the Living Computer Museum, just a couple hours north of me in Seattle, they take that approach that you can walk up and touch the machines and interact with them. And
I know. I've been to the Living Computer Museum and plus Labs, as they now call themselves, and it's just all of the exhibits there are available, and most of them are hands-on.
Wonderful.
Just to sit in front of the Xerox machine and see where the graphical user interface started, and to actually have it power up in front of you, that was brilliant. For me, walking into the mainframe room was more of a feeling like I was back in my mainframe days. But for those that hadn't worked in that kind of environment, it was a great immersive environment. That was one of the few areas that had most of the equipment that was look, some touch, but no use, because it's a different sort of thing. But you were able to get up real close to it, and most of it you could be getting and peering closely at the machines in their raised floor environment, and everything was going. It just wasn't a static display.
Did they give you a little sort of ear protecting headphones things?
Well, nothing was really operating that noisily, and they didn't have any of the band printers going. And I would have loved one of those big band impact printers to go, so that the younger folk could sort of. You hear the ripping noise of a dot matrix printer, but you haven't felt anything until you've stood beside a high speed band printer. belting out onto the onto the wide form paper.
Yeah, that was one of the things I was thinking might be better behind a glass.
Well, back in the day, we did try, you know, so many different types of acoustic hoods and covers and things for those printers. So having those behind glass, you know, triple glazed acoustic insulation, that sort of thing, probably is its natural environment if you look at it, for at least for those high speed printers. But yeah, nothing like a band printer running with its top up so that you can actually see the band moving around. But I think there might be some OH&S issues with little fingers.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't want to relive the nostalgic injuries.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yeah, Mum, where'd my fingers go? Okay. Well, Paul, while you're in front of the microphone there, do we have any listener feedback that we can cover this episode?
That is a good question. Let me look. So I think I'm a little bit behind on accumulating these things, but one thing, there's a couple things I'll note. We've discussed a couple of times in the last couple of episodes the theme song. And
yes, I noticed that it popped up in the Twitter feed and on the Facebook group. There seems to be three camps of people for this. They're the can we change it? The oh, we love it, and the yeah, let's get on with the show group. So
right. Yeah, I was surprised at the degree of support that the existing theme got. So we have gotten several people who have written on Twitter and on Facebook in support of that. So I don't know what that means.
But it's good to know that it's not universally hated or anything.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah, it's nice to be able to say our theme song is not universally hated. Yeah, okay.
That's right. We have cleared.
We're not the worst
the
ones
bar.
Out there.
Yeah, I'm sure the marketing department can do something with that. Okay.
So the other thing I was going to mention was that we essentially got, I think it's an ad, but it was at least a well-targeted ad for something called Breaking the Borders, which seems to be a book about the Atari ST and the creatives behind it. It speaks of the Atari ST book series, and it looks pretty nice. I don't know a thing about it though, apart from, you know, it looks professional. The books look, you know, hardcover and thick, and you know they would injure somebody if you hit them with it. they look nice. But so, do any of you know anything about this? Has anyone seen them?
Nope.
No, not here.
I sort of feel like usually we hear about these things before they appear in what appear to be finished product form. But despite the fact that it was marketing, I think it's relevant enough that we can include the link to it, and people can judge for themselves whether it looks interesting. Are they buyable? They must be buyable. Yes, there are prices. So if you wanted to get the full bundle, the Beyond Creative Bundle, it looks like it is 70 euro, basically. So that's volume 1 and volume 2 of the book, and two bookmarks, and eight-piece postcard series, and some demo art posters, and you know that's the whole thing. And it looks pretty nice, actually, if you're into the Atari ST.
Yeah, and it looks like one of these sort of glossy, full-color books, like we've seen for other platforms as well. Like there's a C64 one, I think there's more than one. I saw an Amiga one the other day. So, like, if you're into, like, just kind of having in nice paper format a way to kind of reminisce about this stuff without even booting up a computer, there you go.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to be mostly focused on, like, the kind of demo scene stuff, the Atari ST portion of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think beyond that, I didn't have any other feedback that I wanted to report, but if you sent us feedback and I didn't just report it, then it'll probably come in on the next one.
Well, we'll take that as a time to drift seamlessly into the items of interest and news. So, Earl, There's you got a little thing here about making some diskettes.
Well, this is a problem that people have from time to time. They get a retro computer, but it doesn't come with any boot disks, any kind of software with it. And then you've got the question, how do I get there from here? Chicken and the egg thing. And this blog entry talks about using a Commodore 128 and a 1571 floppy drive to make disks that are not necessarily for a Commodore, like an MS-DOS disk or a K-Pro disk or an Osborne disk, I think was one of them. And the reason being that the 1571 was a really versatile piece of equipment. Unlike the 1541, the 1571 could really do a lot of stuff. It could read and write a lot of different formats. It could do either GCR encoding or MFM encoding. And with the right software driving it, you can, for instance, make a DOS 360K boot floppy using a Commodore 128. And so in this blog entry, that concept is discussed, and there's also, I believe, a link for some software that you can get that'll actually help you out with this. So I just thought you go out, you buy maybe a PCXT, you think, I got nothing to boot this up with, but you do have a Commodore and a 1571, you could use that to make yourself some disks.
Huh. That's really cool.
So how... It is. So I hadn't actually heard of the 1571 as far as the drive goes. So how common is the 1571?
1571s are pretty common. The 3.5-inch upgrade from that, the 1581, you can still find those, but they're a little less common. But 1571s aren't that hard to come by.
Hmm. Yeah, because I really like this idea of using one retro computer in your collection to create the boot media for another computer in your collection.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nice twist on how do I create a disk type XXX here on my modern Windows, Linux, Mac machine. So, you know, I always like sort of doing more with the machines in my collection. So,
Yeah, I remember having
something
kind
to keep in mind.
I remember it being kind of a hassle to create boot disks for the Compaq portable that I have, because I lead a fairly Apple focused life, and it was kind of hard to find like an appropriate disk to do this with. In fact, I think I wrote them out with using a CryoFlux plugged into my Mac. Eventually, I did manage to create something, but this seems more reliable. I like this idea.
And the 1571s are fairly easy to work on too. Also, if you have a Commodore 128 and a 1571, you can use the Commodore CPM format, but it can also natively read a lot of other CPM formats, because that was another one of those chicken and egg things that when the Commodore 128 and the 1571 came out, they were kind of late to the party in the CPM world, but there was a lot of software available on formats for all the other machines that were out there, like K-Pro and Osborne, that sort of thing. And you can read those formats with the 1571 and write those formats as well. So this software just takes advantage of that capability.
Very cool.
Excellent. Excellent. That is very happy news. So the only thing it means is that I'm going to be looking at a Commodore 128 coming into my collection in a totally new light.
Do you need a Commodore 128 for this? You do, right? To drive the 1571?
I believe you do.
Okay.
Yes.
I think I have one. I'm not sure, but I think I do.
Yeah, just go for a wander through around your stacks and see what you've got in the store there.
I definitely don't have this pizza box style one though. They came in the wedge shape too, right?
The 128 was the wedge shaped, and the 128D or 128DCR are the boxy shape that have a drive built into them.
Okay.
And that drive is a 1571. So if you've got one of the, for instance, Commodore 128 DCRs, that internal drive that it has is a 1571.
Cool.
Okay, so Jack, while I muse adding a one of these Commodore 128s to my collection, what has Rob McMullen been up to?
Well, he has been doing some cool-looking stuff in the latest version of Omnivore he's working on. I know we talked a little bit recently about he gave a presentation at K-Fest that I still have not watched yet, been meaning to. But so Omnivore, for those who don't know, is a pretty cool tool that lets you work with both Atari and Apple II disk images, running them in an emulator, and he's built in specific features for things like viewing memory, for the Atari version, for dealing with Jumpman. So there's like a Jumpman level editor, and there is a way you can write your own code for your own levels that it will sort of link into the normal disk image. So it's pretty cool, and he seems to be using Omnivore as a playground for exploring different ideas about what you could do. So one thing he has is a way to visualize the memory of your system, which is kind of neat. You can see the writes and reads happening. There's different colors flicker on the screen to change. And then he posted an image on Twitter of going back in time. So basically he's saving the frames so you can pause the emulation and then back it up, which is kind of cool. I assume that this works because we're talking about machines that have a limited amount of RAM to begin with. And on a modern machine, it's no big deal to save a whole bunch of 64K frames, you know, up to a certain limit, right? But I haven't yet played this, but it seems very, very cool.
Yeah. The idea of being able to rewind is amazing. Particularly if you were, the thing that leaps to mind for me is trying to crack protected software. Like if you could, if you can rewind back from the point where it failed to try to figure out, to trace the path, rather than having to trace the path forward up until the failure, it might actually be much easier. Yep. And being able to see the memory and stuff, that's just, it's wild.
Yeah. It's pretty crazy. So I think this is not available in like a completed build, but you can grab it from GitHub. It's all open source. And we'll post links to the screenshots, their GIF animations showing what some of the stuff looks like. Pretty cool. I have grabbed various versions of Omnivore now and then and had ambitions to do things, actually to create some Jumpman levels. I've got some great ideas, but I haven't really found the time to get into it all the way. One of these days.
It now occurs to me that I remember a bit of feedback I forgot to mention, which is that Rob wrote to us and said, thanks for mentioning the Kansas Fest talk. So now he can write back again and say, thanks for mentioning Omnivore. Yes. It looks really cool, though.
Yeah, he'll probably ask us if there's some way that we can make Jack watch the video, though, so we'll have to work on that. Okay, well, for all of us who have got so much free time on our hands, I have some good news for you. Retro Challenge has realigned its six-monthly, I suppose we'll call it competitions. So it's gone from the January-July schedule, and it's now going to have the next Retro Challenge is September of this year, which is only days away. So if you've got some retro-inspired idea, follow the link, and you can also have a look at previous entries to look at the scope of what people have done for their entries. So it's everything from the simple through to the insanely difficult. So it's a self-set challenge, and you've got the month of September to get it done and to blog about it while you're doing it. So come along and join us for Retro Challenge 2018-09. I am about to put my entry in. I'm trying to decide between a few projects. Keep failing to complete, and several times I even fail to start. But the sad thing is, I'm not the only one who fails to start. and I'm definitely not the only one who fails to finish. But participation is the name of the game.
Yep.
So, it's
nice to have a little sort of motivating framework, at least.
It is. It is, yeah. I've got, I'm probably going to do something with my 512K Mac. First step is, I suppose, is to make sure it still works. So it's been a few years since I powered it up. And don't worry, folks, there's no batteries left in it. So it's not. I'm not going to have any dissolved motherboard surprises. But it's not an unknown thing that to turn a computer on after 3 years or so to find that it did work, but now it doesn't. So I suppose that's going to be the opening blog for my entry if I go down the 512K, is to, does it work? Oh, no, it doesn't. I'll have to just switch over to my alternate plan. But
I think we ought to come up with a word for the closet rot. Like, how about rentropy?
Rentropy?
That'll do for now.
You heard it. Yeah. You heard it here first, folks.
Yeah. Rentropy. Copyright. Retro Computing Roundtable. Rentropy. Yes, I like that.
Well, I like the word. I don't really like the effect.
Yeah, I don't like when it happens.
Okay, so closet rot and bit rot are all forms of rentropy. Okay, so get your thinking hats on and join us for the Retro Challenge. If you complete your Retro Challenge, there is a great likelihood that you'll be more successful than I. Okay, Paul.
All right.
You have a little brutal offering here.
Yeah. So, but I'm gonna actually make a delayed segue. The thing that Earl talked about, the blog post about making the DOS and CPM boot disks, it is on a site called BIOS Rhythm, I guess, right? And that appears to be Paul Rickard's site. And he is the one who created the Wi-Fi 232 modem and some other stuff. And on the side, he also has something that you can buy from Redbubble. I think this might actually be his creation. But it is a Commodore 64 Marble Madness disk visualization clock. And what it appears to be, there doesn't seem to be any description of this, but what it appears to be is basically a visualization of the data that's on the Marble Madness disk for the Commodore 64. And it's very colorful and looks quite nice. I think it would be a pretty cool thing to have. So I'll have a link to that if you but I think you can find it if you go to the disk blog post entry and look on the side. The segue is basically that this kind of visualization is something that you can make with the applesauce thing that we keep talking about, this Apple Flux Disk Imager. It will read an Apple II disk, and then one of the things you can do is this sort of like polar type graph of the data, which you know sort of looks like a disk, right? I think actually the first time I'd ever seen that was a KFest. Like Hackfest, I think it was, I don't know if it was a Hackfest entry or it was just a thing that was done at KFest by Charles Mangan, where he took this like Apple II disk images and just basically, you know, plotted them using image magic, you know, just in a circle. But it's really, they're sort of compelling, and it feels like you actually are getting information about the disk structure. I mean, you look at it and you can visually see how it works.
Things like SpiroDisk actually are spirally and things like that.
Yeah, and you can particularly see that now with applesauce because normally Apple II disks don't have any way to sense where they are rotationally. There's no sync sensor, but that's one of the pieces of the applesauce is to add a sync sensor. So now you can actually, now the tracks are lined up, you can actually see the spirals.
Mm.
So that brings me to the thing I was going to actually talk about, which was Brutal Deluxe Software released this program, which is called GraphiDisk, which is a ridiculous thing, but it basically allows you to either provide it with a low-resolution graphics image or a string of text, and it will it'll write it to a disk, basically. It'll write your message or your graphics to a disk so that when you read it with an applesauce, you can see the structure of what you designed on the physical disk. As far as I know, the disks can't boot. You know, the only thing they're useful for is imaging them with applesauce and seeing the graphics that you have made. But so it's a ridiculous, ridiculous program. But it's pretty cool. So in order to make it work, you actually I think need to add an extra piece of hardware so that your Apple II can sense the sync signal as well, because it's written on an Apple II. So anyway. It's a hilariously ridiculous program made possible by the imaging capabilities of applesauce. That's it.
It's the sort of thing that if it had been done for a retro challenge entry, it probably would have. Well, if I was judging, would have won hands down. Yeah. It's that wonderful blend of retro computing, hardware, software. And absolute silliness. It's everything all rolled up into one. So does it have any real world use? No. is it silly? Most definitely. Do I want to do this? Oh yes.
Well, and the thing is, like, you know, for some games, you know, they don't use the whole disc. So games that were published in 1982, they single load. They use like, you know, 8 tracks of the disc or whatever, and there's much of the space is left over. I would love it if, you know, someday somebody images one of these discs and it turns out that there was a message.
No, that's something I was thinking of, is sort of like, yeah, can I get the boot track and the executable out on the outlying edges, and then as you said, so like have the rest there, and then so like pull that data into the program, you know, that'd be a great retro challenge.
Yeah, I think it'd be pretty cool to arrange the data in such a way that it actually forms the character in the game, whatever, like a little Space Invader guy.
Mm.
But anyway, that's Graphidisc. So if you're interested in doing this, there is a link. I think you need an applesauce to image it back out. I think you need an applesauce even to make it in the first place, because you have to because you need the sync sensor. So, but if you have one, here you go. And if you don't have one, actually, there is at least one more run planned. So just, you know, get yourself on the list.
Yeah, well, mine's sitting in a box here waiting for me to put the sync sensor in and get some discs here of mine. I want to use it as a recovery tool. There's some non-booting discs. I want to see if I can recover something off them.
Good luck.
I think I'll need it. Okay, Earl, do you have a favorite instruction set?
You know, I have a fear of commitment to a specific instruction set. But I will say that if your favorite instruction set was one of the old classics like 6502 or Z80 or 68000, and if you're interested in the maker community, electronic gadgets and doodads, then you might be in luck, because I noticed this article on Hackaday about something called the Retro Microcontroller. This is a chip that's part of a project called Chips for Makers, and it's going to be an open source implementation. It'll be a chip that, rather than having one of the current modern instruction sets on it, it's going to instead have 3 different instruction sets that you can choose from: 6502, Z80, Z80 for my overseas compatriots, and 68000. It's a crowdsourced effort. They're seeking funding on CrowdSupply. If they make it, then in, I guess, April of 2019, this will actually come out as a product, and you can buy it in multiple ways. You could just get the chip itself in a surface mount form factor, it looks like, or you can buy a board that has headers on it and some support chips and you could make projects with this cool microcontroller that speaks the instruction sets that we know and love from the past.
And so this would be cheaper than an FPGA then, because it's sort of like already burned in, right?
Well, the chip itself would. If you buy the actual board, I'm trying to remember what the cost was if you get the board. Let me look it up here. They have something that they call the Retrino, which is the retro microcontroller on a board that has the same header footprint as an Arduino Mega.
Mm-hmm.
And that's $89. And you might think, well, that seems like it'd be cheaper than an FPGA, but I'm not sure, because there are FPGA boards that you can get in that price range. In fact, if you dig a little deeper on this project, this Chips for Makers project, you'll see that although they haven't actually made the custom silicon yet for this, they do have the cores for these running on an FPGA board.
Yeah, okay.
That specific FPGA board that they're using is called the XLR8, Accelerate, and that board has an Intel/Altera FPGA on it. It's called the MAX-10, and I think you can get that board for roughly the same price range, or maybe even a little bit cheaper. So I don't know. It's a kind of a question mark. Is this cheaper than an FPGA? Certainly this is simpler than an FPGA, because you'll just get this Retrino board that is part of this crowd supply project and just plug it in and work with it, mm-hmm. as opposed to having to jump through any kind of hoops to program the FPGA. I love this Chips for Makers project, though, this whole thing, where they're taking these retro instruction sets, making cores for them. The cores are available if you want to take them and port them to another board, as I understand it. I was reading through some of the blog entries. Somebody shoot me if I'm getting any of this wrong. But the fact that also you can just buy the individual chips is kind of cool, too, because if you wanted to make your own board or project based on this, instead of getting that whole board, you could just get the surface mount chips and do it that way. So reading directly from the crowd supply page, it says the chip contains the Z80, MOS6502, and Motorola 68000 cores. The active core is externally selected during reset, or it can be changed through the JTAG interface. JTAG is a common electronics programming kind of interface. The chip itself has 72 GPIO pins, and the other interesting thing is that they're 5-volt compatible.
Nice.
A lot of modern projects, a lot of modern boards these days are 3.3 volts, which makes it a little bit more problematic to interface those things with our old favorite retro computers that are almost universally 5 volts. So the fact that this is 5-volt tolerant, 5-volt interactive is also kind of a thumbs up.
Cool. So I have to think of a project, but it's cool that it could exist.
Mm-hmm.
More toys to play with. Maybe I should do a PowerPoint presentation about that.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, well, that very, very bad segue is I have an article that I found over on Medium, the emergence of presentation software and the prehistory of PowerPoint. And I haven't fully read it, but as one who occasionally inflicts PowerPoint upon others, it was a very interesting stroll back, and I basically went straight from doing overhead projector slides in whatever word processor package I had on whatever machine it was, and then I would print those onto the transparencies and use that deck on the overhead projector. And before that, of course, I used to use the reel-to-reel film on an overhead projector, similar to what was inflicted upon me back in my university days. I'm sure most of us will remember the lecturer up the front advancing the role of clear transparency over the overhead projector and scrawling their notes up onto the screen. So, yeah, it's an interesting article on the prehistory of PowerPoint. One of my favorite slides in here is actually one of the creators, Dennis Austin, the principal developer of PowerPoint, using an overhead projector to give a presentation on PowerPoint.
Nice.
Many of us have had the 35mm slides in the carousel, and that used to be considered a multimedia presentation. But the one I like the most is the early LCD frames that you would plug into your computer and then sit the LCD frame on top of your overhead projector. And the overhead projector basically was your backlight for the LCD, which then would reflect the image from the LCD up onto the screen or the conveniently placed white wall. So that was always a fun device to try and get in focus and use that. From the VGA out, I remember using it from a PS2. So,
I'm pretty sure somewhere I do have one of those things that you did, like what you're talking about, that you an actual LCD that light's supposed to shine through.
Mm.
I'm curious to see how. Oh, because I'm not sure if I can find an actual projector now that I think about it.
Oh, well, funny you should mention, I actually had the opportunity to get hold of an overhead projector. Someone, friend at work, his daughter had a retro party, and they were using sourced an overhead projector, and they were just using that to put things up onto the wall. And I took that off their hands, so I've got the overhead projector. I'm currently looking for the LCD screen to go with it.
I see.
Yeah, we should have a hardware get together sometime. Just I don't want to take an overhead projector as my carry-on luggage for an international flight.
No, probably not. I think probably the little the thing that you put on it is not small, but it's still probably a little more portable.
Yeah. It was always fun sort of like trying to get the right light level in the room. Normally if you blacked out the room, it wasn't too much of a problem, but even when they were new, I found that some of those models weren't the greatest color quality or even just image quality to come up. Being away from the flat surface of the overhead projector, it was a challenge sometimes to focus in. Seemed to be a bit out of the focal range of the overhead projector. But if you want to have a little bit of a look at the prehistory of PowerPoint, and of course I do have a copy of Forethought's PowerPoint before it became a Microsoft product.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that that was mainly the thing that I knew about PowerPoint before reading this article was that it was originally developed by Taylor Pullman and Rob Campbell, looks like, for Forethought, and then Microsoft basically bought it and stuck a Microsoft sticker on it, essentially.
Well, actually, yeah, the first release of it from Microsoft was literally exactly the same packaging and with a Microsoft sticker on the box and a bit of Microsoft blurb sheet added into the box, and was basically originally Microsoft Forethought PowerPoint.
Yeah. I think I have the one with the sticker. I don't have the one, I don't have the actual Forethought one, but...
Mm.
And we interviewed, we talked with Taylor Pullman on Drop 3 Inches, that podcast that is hasn't had a new episode for a year now, but so a minor little plug for that.
Okay, so Paul.
Hi, so I'm next.
Another, a museum.
Yeah, so this, was a, you know, so I guess I put this in here a little while ago, but August 10th, I guess, Andromeda Yelton wrote, I have an hour or two to kill in Bozeman. So this is Bozeman, Montana. So I found this hole-in-the-wall computer history museum, and wow, this is not what I expected. And this is basically just like a long Twitter thread of sort of photographs of this, I think, probably not particularly well-known and or particularly accessible computer museum in Bozeman, Montana. And it's got some pretty impressive displays and pretty impressive stuff in there, and it's really it's well documented, first of all, by Andromeda Yelton, and who is at that Andromeda on Twitter. And I think it came to people's attention because Steve Wozniak retweeted it, so it kind of got a lot of play, and in fact led the museum itself to start a Twitter account specifically so that they you know could link to this. So it is now possible, as a result of Andromeda Yelton visiting the museum, it is now possible to follow the museum on Twitter.
Yes, and the presentation that was all retweeted, I just love how the opening picture is. So what if we had 4,000-year-old Mesopotamian tablets? Sure, okay, here's a picture of one.
Yeah.
And there it is. Some cuneiform right there in front of you. And if that wasn't great enough, rapidly followed by a Shakespeare folio. So
it's
beautiful.
It's amazing what they have. They have I think they had a bit of like, something from Apollo.
I haven't even got there. I'm still looking at Newton's Philosophiae Naturalis Principia.
Anyway, so it's definitely worth reading through the thread. If you happen to be in Bozeman, it'd be worth going to the place too. But
I think Bozeman, Montana is going to be on my next trip to Kansas Fest.
It's about an 11.5-hour drive from me.
Oh, that's actually not Portland. Super, super far.
It's not terrible.
Yeah, I'll meet you there.
Yeah, sounds good.
Excellent. Anyway, that's all I just wanted to highlight it because it was a pretty interesting museum I'd never heard of that has a really impressive collection and a very nice sort of documentation of a visit of it as well.
A very, very good documentation of the visit. I like well-constructed tweet feeds like that. So, Earl, you've got a question for us.
Yeah, it's a quick question, I think, because I think I know the answer. But I'm curious, we collect a lot of computers and even some of the peripherals that went with them, but printers are always like the black sheep of the family, that they don't get collected. Sometimes you can't give them away. And they were a pretty important part of the computing experience in the 80s. I might be a little partial because I worked for Epson, and at the time that I worked for them, they, I think, pretty much owned the dot matrix printer market. They'd had the MX-80 followed on by the FX-80 super popular printers that, everybody and their brother had one.
Including brother.
And, the clones came out like, Star Micronics had some clones of the Epson printers. Okidata had some printers that had Epson-compatible control codes.
That was a big marketing thing. It's like Epson-compatible, fully Epson-compatible. Yeah, it was sort of like, and we do our own stuff as well.
Exactly. And they were probably a lot cheaper because the Epson printers were pretty pricey. They were really high quality, but they were also pretty highly priced. So I'm just curious what you guys think about this, why printers wind up being the thing that don't get collected. I have my thoughts, but I'm not going to muddy the water. I'd rather hear you guys.
A lot of them are big and heavy. I must admit that's the main reason I've got my original image writer that came with my Apple II back in 84. I accidentally collected an Apple PostScript printer, but I have actually just been using that because it's a nice laser printer. It uses the same toner cartridge as the HP2, so it's a still very common and available toner cartridge. I know some people don't like them because they're noisy, my image writer, yes, it's a bit on the noisy side. I can still buy ribbons for it, and I do like to use it every now and again. So I do actually have another printer. I've actually got to find the paper for it because it's a thermal printer. So that's another problem is the thermal printers, the aluminium. I won't say foil because it's not, but the paper that's got the aluminium surface, and effectively you're using the print head to burn or blast through the aluminium to leave your marks. So they are problematic along those lines, because at least with our retro computers we have all these various cables, dongles and units to hook them into modern monitors so that we can keep going that way. But
what I was going to say was that it's the consumables. I mean, I think that's probably the biggest problem, is that they're designed to run through stuff that is no longer made.
Oh yes.
So it's hard to find, you know, whatever fanfold paper, tractor feed paper. It's quite hard to find the thermal paper and whatever stuff you've preserved. You know, like I have a bunch of, you know, image writer ribbons or whatever that I'm sure are just dry.
Even though they're in sealed plastic, there's a good chance that they have dried up.
Yeah.
Though there have been enterprising people who have actually made new batches. I know for the Image Writer 2, a color impact printer, that color ribbons have been made for it, and they've been quite a popular item as they've gone around the Apple II and Macintosh news groups. But
I bought like 4 or 5 or something of those, and of course then immediately I just sort of stuck them in a box. So I'm hoping that they don't dry out before I wind up using them. But that's, they take up a lot of space, they're heavy to ship, and the consumable aspect of it I think is what keeps me from wanting them. I don't mind having an instance of every printer. I'm just looking. I can see 4 Image Writer 2s from my seat here. But I think. But I don't want 4. I mean, maybe I want 2 because there are 2 variants. But
You could print duplex then.
Right. Yeah.
Feed the paper through one, then have it have a inverter flipper, and then feed it through the second one. I kid you not, I've continuous laser printers and inkjet printers all used to do that when they couldn't get the 2 heads operating either side of the paper. You'd have one printer which would print the front and another printer which would print the back, and you'd have a paper inverter, normally a roller with a right angle in it, so that the paper would then feed into the second device, and they were synchronized so that you got page 1 on one side and page 2 on the other. A bit embarrassing if you were doing that for commercial printing and you got your pages out of sequence.
Yeah.
But, there's a retro challenge for you, Paul. Duplex printing on a Image Writer 2 with an inverter between the 2 devices.
Yeah, seems like it'd be kind of cool. But yeah, I was also thinking, I have like a Next laser printer. I really kind of wonder if any of these things, at some point I'm not going to be able to get the toner for it. Maybe that time is already here, you know. And so at that point they really are just useless. They're decorations. They're heavy decorations that take up space. Mm. I don't know. What are your thoughts, Earl?
Well, so you can still get the consumables for some of the more popular ones, like the
Epson?
You know, the Epson printers, the Oki Data printers, it seems like you can still get the ribbons for those. You can still buy fanfold paper from some of the online office stationery supply stores, but it's really expensive. I think in a lot of cases you'll pay more for those consumables than you would for the printer, because if you're fortunate, somebody will probably just give you the printer, but then you have to buy those other things, so that's money. And yeah, the cost of shipping those heavy things, you need to find one that's local to you for you to be able to collect it, because if you want it shipped, then you're going to pay. So I agree with all the sentiments you guys say. I just wonder if sometime in the future we're going to look back and go, wow, there was a whole super important kind of mission critical piece of computing that everybody used back then, and we got none of them left because mm-hmm. nobody ever collected them, nobody preserved them, and now they're gone and we just have videos or something like that.
Yeah. Well, hopefully not, but I also am not volunteering to be the person who collects them.
I'm with you. I'm not going there either. So I do have a couple of them, and you know, I'm going to keep the ones I have, although I had some 90s circa dot matrix printers that I did actually take to Goodwill because they weren't old enough to collect and they weren't new enough to be of value. So I did get rid of those, but the 80s ones that I have, I've got three of the Oki Datas and one of the FX85s, and those are staying with me, but I don't know when they're going to see use.
So there's still a chance of you starting the Portland printer place?
Still a chance, yes. The chance is...
You could have an online presence and call it the Portland printer portal.
Yes, the chance is statistically not zero.
So, let's just wrap that up there, and so here's a word from one of our vintage sponsors.
Hello. In the last commercial for the Compact Portable 2, I said that it sets new standards in full-function portable computing. Now look, I want to come clean about this. I have absolutely no idea what it means. But anyway, the Compact Portable 2 certainly does set these new standard things in full-function portable computing. And, that's the number. So, three cheers for it, I say. Hip hip!
Hooray!
Hip hip!
Hooray!
Hip hip!
Hooray!
When you have your own business, you eat your own mistakes. So while everybody else was getting a personal computer, I waited until a friend who really knows computers said, get the Epson. Why? For starters, the Epson speaks English, with buttons and keys you understand instantly. Want to draw a graph? Push draw. In less than a day, I was getting the help I got a computer for. I'm glad I waited for the Epson, because now I can forget all the computerese I never learned.
Hello. You may remember I've been telling you all about Compaq's wonderful new portable computer. Well, I've made a mistake. Apparently, I should never have mentioned Compaq's portable computer. I should have been telling you about Compaq's Desk Pro computer. Now, the point of buying the Desk Pro is that it's so heavy, nobody can possibly tell you to take it home with you. And they come in a very nice box. So, please forget all our earlier commercials. Thank you.
And welcome back. So, host retro computing gift idea. Now, this one I would classify as a doozy. When I saw this one, I just instantly thought, I've got to have one. And then I got distracted by something else in one of my other goldfish moments, and I haven't got it yet, but here it is for you. Do you need 64 gigabytes of storage for your laptop that just oozes retro? Well, we have here the 64 gigabyte Pentode Radio Tube flash drive. So follow the link and be prepared to be amazed.
Yeah, this is awesome. I use that word a lot, but I should maybe even include an exclamation point this time.
Well, I felt that awesome of yours was like a Carrington awesome. It was all uppercase with two exclamation points at the end.
That's right.
Okay, but yeah, I would love to sort of be somewhere and someone says, oh, would you like a copy of that? And I say, oh, yes, I have here my USB flash drive. Just copy it onto this for me, please. And then pass them this.
So I think you should describe it for those who are not actually looking at it, though.
Yeah, okay. Radio doesn't do this justice.
Okay. Well, first off, are you old enough to remember a radio tube, a vacuum tube? So we have here a pentode radio tube, and when you plug this into the USB slot, some of the power, which is not needed necessarily for its ancillary task of storing 64 gigabytes of data, it uses it to light up the tube. So it is a good old-fashioned radio tube. You've got some lights, and I'm hoping that the light actually fluctuates with the as a read-write indicator, but if it doesn't, it just looks pretty as it is. So it is literally taking a steampunkified industrial type, as they say there, USB drive, and just totally out of character, plugged into that thin aluminium MacBook or your black Windows laptop or whatever you're using, or just sort of like sticking it into the front USB drive of that boring Dell or HP desktop computer.
It says radio vacuum tube was made in USSR in 1981.
Yeah, so it's a real tube. And across the pond, don't they call them valves? Do I have that right?
Oh, yeah. I think they might.
Valves. Yeah, mostly a valve. I would call it a valve, but if someone said radio tube, I totally understand what they're talking about. Just in the same way as I automatically translate Z80 to the correct speak.
Yeah, and I think I would have called it a vacuum tube, although a vacuum tube that you'd find in a radio.
This is retro meets art meets actually useful.
Yeah.
So question, Mr. Carter. So question number one, do I have to wait for the tube to warm up before I can use my USB drive? And question number two, who's writing their copy for them on this Amazon ad? Because it's just, they're going to lose customers by just having a description that's just a random bunch of words.
It's like an eBay listing, isn't it?
Yeah, tags. Stick, thumb, pen, key, drive, storage, memory, disk. And then it goes to metal handwork, handcraft, exclusive, unique, best, cool, great, retro, vintage, gadget, device.
Yeah.
Idea for Christmas, New Year, birthday, present gift for geek man, him, dad, boy, teen, for computer, tablet, PC, notebook, laptop, Mac.
And we're not making this up, folks.
Dear listener, have you heard of the word verbatim? And I don't mean the floppy disk. So that was the listing for this device. The listing is pure bleep. The device itself is just pure bliss.
Indeed.
$69, I'd buy that.
You should get it even if you're not a geek man, him, dad, boy, teen, I think. It's still applicable, even if you're not one of those.
That is totally going to be, I'm going to make that into my Twitter bio, I'm pretty sure. Geek man, him, dad, boy, teen.
Yeah. I do think it does appear that this is, it's the people who make it. You know, it's not like just one of several Amazon accounts that are selling, versions of the same thing. And there are actually some photos in the customer reviews. You can see, you can see what they look like, in the hands of customers. They are actual glass, which might be a potential concern.
Right.
You have to treat it well, not just toss it in your backpack and then toss your heavy things in after it.
That's true. I didn't think about it being fragile, but you're right.
But it's still, yeah. I mean,
whatever though. It's amazingly cool.
Get a little carrying case or something. How did they carry tubes around in the 1981s in the USSR? whatever those are. Get a case of those.
Even before then, they basically just came in a thin cardboard box. Remember light bulbs?
A light bulb. Yeah, right.
That's exactly it. I have a vacuum tube that looks almost exactly like this one in my collection.
How many gigabytes of storage?
It has approximately 1 bit of storage, I believe. And the one that I have is just, it's an RCA, and it's just in a cardboard box, like Michael was just describing. So nothing special. So, yeah, you'll have to be careful, but, you know, it's worth it. Do you suppose the light that's on this is artificial, like an LED or something in there, or do you think the tube itself is actually drawing some power and lighting up?
Well, I was kind of hoping that it was drawing power and lighting up, but I don't know. Maybe we should ask iFixit to do a teardown.
Yeah, I kind of assumed that it was an LED, just because I assume these things draw actually quite a lot of power compared to what a laptop is prepared to give out.
Are you thinking it might want more than the 500 milliamps of 5 volt? In all likelihood, probably, but...
Or your laptop... now lasts 8 minutes.
That could be too
on the battery charge.
Yeah, and burns out your USB port.
I was kind of hoping the screen dims as you plug in the USB drive. Well, let's move along to everyone's favorite section, eBay auctions. So, Earl, shock, horror, gasp, an Epson printer. Where did you ever get the idea for that?
It just popped into my head. And I thought, you know, are these being sold on eBay? And yeah, there were quite a few of them. This particular one, vintage Epson MX80 dot matrix printer. I picked this one because the MX80, it wasn't the first dot matrix that Epson made. The first commercial one they made of this style was the TX80, which weighed a ton and didn't do very well in the market. But the MX80 is where the rocket really took off. So if I was going to get a classic Epson printer to have in the collection, this would be the one I'd want. And this has one of the keywords that I love in an eBay auction.
Pinned.
Tested. Oh. That's right.
I thought it was Teen Man Boy.
And, you know, they actually show this thing making a little bit of a printout. Very light, because probably the ribbon, you know, per Paul at consumables. But so this wasn't terrible either, in that it's $50 and there's a make offer button. So you could offer free, I suppose. I don't know if eBay allows that, but they're also charging $50 for shipping to me from Texas. I don't know what it is for you guys, but that's not a surprise, again, just based on how much these things weigh. But thought I'd throw one of these in there.
Very cool. I love the shape of these. There's, I mean, I think it, you know, it's only, it's just nostalgia, but this just brings the time back perfectly for me. I was trying to figure out... I knew that I had for a while been seeking, you know, one of these types out, and I was trying to remember if it was a like an RX80 or an FX80 or, you know, MX80 that I had. And I got out my phone to, you know, sort of like look in my little database, and I realized that I'm actually like sitting right next to the box that says Epson MX80 on it. I have a, you know, like a nice blue and white actual box. Quite cool.
Oh, very nice.
But I definitely like these printers. Apart from the ImageWriter 2, I want to have one of, because it sort of interfaces with all of the Apple things of the era. But the MX80 I want, you know, for the, you know, if I'm going to have just one sort of like PC type dot matrix printer, it would be this one.
As crazy as it is, these dot matrix printers were so expensive that people would actually hook them up to multi-computer switch boxes so that we could share them. Mm-hmm. Like in aerospace, when I worked in that environment, we'd have two or three people in an office environment, and they'd have a switch box, sometimes a manual switch box that you walk up to and chonk, chonk, you know, switch so that you could share the printer and not have to buy two or three of them.
Yeah.
Okay, so I might just get in my few small items before we find out what Paul's been up to. So the first one that I've got is adding 20 megabytes of hard drive to your retro computer. So back in the day, hard drives were coming in, and one way of adding them was to just to slot it into your machine. And I literally mean slot it in. So into an ISA slot, you could put this item and you would be off and running with 20 megabytes. And what could you ever store on 20 megabytes of hard drive? I don't know. It's just ridiculous amounts of storage. So this is a great way of adding some additional storage to your IBM PC XT, or even a compatible for that matter. These were all the rage back in the day.
Well, they solved two problems. One was it gave you some hard drive space, and the second was it avoided you having to mount the hard drive and cable it up. And, you know, sounds simple, but...
And actually having somewhere on the motherboard to plug in. So there was none of this built-in hard drive controllers in your motherboard back then.
That's right. You'd need to have a Western Digital or some type of controller like that.
You were lucky to be able to plug in directly to the motherboard for your floppy drive. Yeah, most of the time you had to have a controller card for your floppies anyway. So this, as you said, it's one complete package. You know, take it out, take the cover off the slot, pop this in, and you're off.
Simple.
It's not super expensive either. I wonder if the hard drive works. I mean, that's the problem with hard drives.
It is. Yeah, it has here, this card was working when added to my personal collection, but however, due to time and storage untested, do not know if it's in working condition. So, I shouldn't have said that, because that Earl's going to get all upset. So, no, it would have been nice to know if it does still work, but for $35 US, I would be willing to take that chance if I was looking for a little bit of hard drive storage for my IBM PC.
Yeah, you know, this actually is another category of things that, you know, like the printers, the hard drives of the 80s. I mean, people do collect them, but they're all going to be dead at some point.
Oh, you are such a cheery person today, aren't
yes.
you, Paul?
Well, I mean, we all are. You know, eventually the sun is going to go out and all that stuff. But I mean, like, it sort of seems like much sooner than that, all of the hard drives from the 1980s will cease to function. Just sort of a sobering thought, but
it's kind of sad. I mean, there were a couple of hard drives from this era, like the Seagate 225 and the Seagate 251, which were 20 and 40 megabytes, respectively. Those were so stinking common and popular back then. But if you go out looking for one now on eBay or something like that, in a lot of cases, they're selling for a lot more than I want to pay for them.
Mm-hmm.
And in a lot of those cases, to Michael's point, they don't even say if they work. It's just... Mm-hmm. Here, you know, here's a drive, good luck.
Mm-hmm.
And with a drive from that era, I think if it's being sold like that, it's more likely it doesn't work than it does, unless you say you've tested it.
And it's probably pretty hard to test.
Well, yeah. What are you going to plug it into? I'm with Michael, though, on this one. If I was looking for something like this, I'd probably take the risk at that price, because that's not a bad price.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and if it doesn't work, it's a nice little bit of computer nostalgia. I'd put it in a shadow box frame and I'd hang it up on the wall. It's just got that difference. But what I like about this is that, really, we're going the full circle, because in my Mac Pro under the desk, I actually have a Sonnet drive, for want of a better word. It's a controller card, a PCIX slot. It has a pair of 256 gigabyte SSDs on it. So, I needed some extra storage on my Mac Pro. The four main drive bays were full. The boot drive is already on a separate card, and I wanted some more storage, and I just got lazy. I haven't got round to putting the optical drive kit in to the second optical bay. So I just I've got this slot in SSD card. So yeah, everything old is new again. It's just as I said, it's this one's got a pair of 256 gigabyte SSDs as opposed to this one with a massive 20 megabyte hard drive.
Cool.
Okay, so Paul, on your little walks through eBay, what have you found this week?
Well, let's see. I have, prepare yourself, a kind of miscellaneous list of items. But
what?
Bingo!
Yes. But all right, so the first one that I have is a Canon, is it still available? Yeah, Canon XO7 handheld computer. This is not something I had seen before, somehow. Although it, apparently they're fairly common, but it's kind of like a mix between a computer and a calculator. It calls itself a handheld computer. It has BASIC in it. It often came in this little case that has a printer with it, and like not a printer, but a plotter. It says printer, but I mean it's a plotter. And it looks pretty cool, actually.
Oh, I think it looks exceedingly cool, and you know it's got something that our modern day handheld computers / phones don't have. It's got a plotter. It's got a it's got the screen, but you know, does your Android phone have a printer plotter on it? No, mine doesn't.
Right. Anyway, yeah. So if you're looking for something like this, I don't. My impression is that they're not super common, or I would have come across one before. But reading up on them, it does seem like they were very popular, possibly in Europe, though. This is, I guess I should say, it's a $300 buy it now. It is shipping from France. Okay, so that would explain my thought that it was in Europe. So if you're in France, it might be cheaper to ship. There you go. Jack, are you going to get it?
No, I'll pass.
Okay. Good.
Right. Not going to pop down there over the weekend.
We'll leave it to the listeners.
We'll leave it for a listener.
The next thing I have, I thought this was kind of cool. This is only just based on the look of it, but it is a LexisNexis terminal. I think the listing showed an ad. Maybe I'm not seeing it anymore, but some sort of computer ad for like this is a thing you can use to access the.
It's the last picture in the slide series. Have to advance through.
So, I have no idea if this is actually useful for anything, because, of course, I'm sure you can't actually access LexisNexis with it anymore, but it looks beautiful. It's this all-in-one unit. It's got a screen and a keyboard. The case of the monitor is red. It actually looks relatively small.
Well, the ad's got the pair of hands on the keyboard, so it's not a massive terminal.
No, it's actually quite...
It's not definitely not a full size keyboard.
So it would be kind of a cute thing to have.
Yeah. Yeah. Is it $800 cute though?
Mead Data Central. It says on it in a couple of different places. And I think it is just a dedicated terminal. So like it needs some sort of like dial-in LexisNexis access point. And so it would be interesting to see if it could actually be used to do anything at all. What does it say? Because of telephone problems, it has not been possible to establish communication with the MDC computer, it says, when you turn it on. So, but it at least displays something. Anyway, it's cute. It's too expensive for anyone to actually want, but you can make an offer. Yeah, it is in Laguna Beach, California. Buy it now for $800, so... Feel free to jump in and comment. I intend most of these things to be kind of like conversation starters, but
sure.
That terminal, I'm still speechless.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
The color is amazing. The keyboard is amazing.
Yeah,
but yeah,
I would love to just find one somewhere, rather than have to buy one shipped from California. But actually, the problem with these things, and probably. I think of that as being also the problem with the IBM 5150 and the Apple III, is that these are sort of business machines, and businesses are not nostalgic entities. And so when the next thing comes along, these go in the trash. So Okay, so the next thing I have is the vintage Unitech Dataphone TMS-1A. And there may have been one of these at some point in the past as well, but it's basically it's a combination modem phone, 300 baud modem that you can get. So it's very, I don't know, oddly useless now in the days when nobody even has a landline anymore. But I still thought it was kind of cute, and it's it's not super expensive. It is a $26.26 for some reason. Buy it now. Did any of you have one of these things, a dedicated like modem phone?
No,
no, I only had two lines to the house, so there's modem on one line right. For the computers, and I had a separate phone mm-hmm. to use, but not a combination one.
Yeah, this actually has like a little switch that you can like switch it between modem and data, like modem and voice. Connects directly to phone jack and computer. I have this feeling that this, if it wasn't this exact thing, it was something like this. It was advertised in the DAC catalog, these like little surplus things. I think that the DAC catalog was also the place that was one of the outlets for the PX8, I think, right?
Yes, actually, that sounds right, because some of the, they actually even had a little value add software bundle that they made for the PX8 when they were in liquidation.
Yeah, that was a great catalog. They're definitely worth, tracking down and reading if you can find scans of them. All right, let's see. Next thing. So this is a Seiko RC1000 terminal watch for the Commodore 64, and I think this is pretty cool. There were a few of these kinds of things, in the sort of middle 80s, I guess. But this, it's basically a watch that would connect to your Commodore that you could sort of download, transfer information from your Commodore to your watch so that then you would have access to it on your watch. I think that's mainly what it was. I don't think you could enter stuff on the watch to transfer to your Commodore. I think it went the other way. But there probably aren't many of these left. I hadn't heard of one before I saw this that went to the Commodore. I knew that there was one that went to the Apple II. But looks pretty cool.
Do you have any idea what kind of data you could display? Was it like for like your contacts, address book, calendar, what?
That's my guess. It's a little tiny screen.
Super tiny.
But I would assume it's something like phone numbers and calendar.
Yeah.
Earl, have you in your Commodore travels, have you come across one of these ever?
I've never seen one of these.
Yeah, I've never seen this either. I remember in the early 90s seeing someone at a job I was working at who had a similar kind of thing. It was a watch that they could send data to the watch only from a computer. And the way it worked was they would hold the watch up in front of the computer screen, and the screen would flash, like just like black and white at a certain, at like a high frequency, essentially, doing like what a modem does, sending one bit at a time.
Mm-hmm.
They could transfer like a dump of whatever to the watch by holding their watch up in front of the screen. It was had some tiny receptor on the front, and they put it in a mode, and it would just read that. So,
yeah.
Wireless.
Yeah, that's really cool.
So just found some notes for it. The watch can store notes, phone numbers, and most importantly, combination of scheduled and reoccurring alarms.
Cool. And this auction actually comes with the disc.
It just looks to be one way. Yeah.
It's pretty wild. There actually is an article that I have a link to somewhere in the show notes that I've. It's in exhibit. .com, which we've linked to various things from them before, but talking about this Seiko UC2000 from 1984, which is a similar kind of thing, but this one's even more crazy because it has like a little docking station that you can put it into to program it. And I think actually there's also like a calculator attachment as well. So like an actual sort of calculator sized attachment that this thing can sit on. So it's basically a keyboard for your watch, I think. So I'll put a link to that. Most of these things are all like Japanese ads, but This is a very quite nice sort of photo essay. That's one of the things that inexhibit.com is good at.
So I've also added a link for the watch for details on connecting it, memory layout. Very nice blog post here.
Ah, cool. I forgot to look how much this auction is for, but I'm sure it's the starting bid is $279.
$79.
Yeah, so that's you know, whatever. It's I'm not convinced that's too much. Oh, this is interesting. This is so. I also only just noticed who the seller was. I think over the last few episodes linked to a number of auctions from Sci-Fi Man in it's somewhere in Canada, Nova Scotia. This is a fairly large, fairly impressive collection of things of, you know, interesting things of this time. So it's probably also worth looking at the other items as well. And if you're in Canada, even better. If you're in Nova Scotia, even better. Okay, let's see. I think the last thing I have is the this DBase 2 key ring, which I thought was pretty cool. So I programmed in DBase 2 for a fair amount of my life, and so I really kind of like that logo, the DBase on the super thick 2. It's very, very pleasing. It's like an inch and a quarter or something. It's like a little square. It's a key ring. And I think what's kind of interesting about it is on the back it says, drop in any mailbox, Ashton Tate, and you know, gives an address in Culver City, California, with a number, 6117, return postage guaranteed. And so I guess what this would mean is that you registered it with Ashton Tate. Like, unless this actually was an internal Ashton Tate thing, you would presumably register your number with Ashton Tate so that if they received these at some point, they could look up 6117 and get your keys back to you. But so don't drop it now, because otherwise it'll just get mailed to some, you know, whoever's at that address now. That's it. Everybody's speechless.
Yep. All stunned.
But it is a nice key ring.
Yeah. I do kind of like this sort of added danger, though, of accidentally losing it and having somebody find it and mail it to this defunct address.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd be adding it to my actual daily key ring.
Right. Anyway, that's it. I'm all out of eBay auctions.
All eBayed out. Okay, well, let's look at docking this show and bringing it in. So, closing discussions. So, Earl, this looks interesting.
So, I connected a VT100 terminal to a little serial to Wi-Fi bridge that is made from a Wi-Fi chip that's real popular in the maker community, the ESP8266 chip, and it works great. And I'm running some firmware. I think the firmware is actually from Bo Zimmerman, who is a prominent person in the Commodore community. But you don't have to use a Commodore with this firmware. It just works like an old Hayes-compatible modem with AT commands. Except you don't ATDT a phone number, you ATDT a IP address or a fully qualified domain name, and you connect up to it with Telnet. So one of the fun things that I did, in addition to Telnetting to a couple of Telnet BBS systems, was to Telnet straight up to another local computer on my home network that was running an Altair simulator based on SimH. So I had my VT100 connected up to a FACO Altair and was doing some CPM kind of stuff with it. So it's just really fun. It's a way to use the old real terminal with some services that you can get to on Telnet, whether they're real or not. It has that retro feel. So just having fun with that, thought I'd throw it out. I think I had tweeted something that I actually tweeted from the VT100 straight through that. I'd telnetted into a Linux box or something, but I thought it was pretty cool. I was using a command line client to tweet straight off the terminal.
Excellent.
And that's it.
That's cool.
That's all I got to add.
What do you think of the keyboard? Like, how is it to type on?
A VT100 terminal is actually has a pretty nice keyboard. I like the feel of it.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I think in college we had something that was VT100-esque. I'm not sure they were actual VT100s, but I think I remember liking typing on them.
Yeah, I think there were VT102s.
Yeah.
Like that. Which I don't know how similar that is to the 100.
I think it had the same keyboard.
Okay.
I think so. And yeah, it has it doesn't have a click feel, but it has a pretty satisfying kerchunk when you hit the keys.
I hope that all future auctions will have it has a pretty satisfying kerchunk feel - Earl Evans.
I hope so, because I could use some royalties from this stuff.
Yes, kerchunk like it's the 1970s. Okay, so, Paul, was it Mastodon week?
Yeah, well, so when I wrote that, it was last week, so Twitter, and so I wonder actually if this is going to have any effect on the availability of command line clients as well and stuff, but Twitter basically yanked the rug out of a lot of the third-party clients. So I don't know to what extent everybody who's listening to me uses, the actual Twitter.com webpage and how many people use third-party clients, but it just last week, I think, became impossible for them to real-time stream the things as they came in, and there's some other statistics that people no longer have access to, except possibly through some super expensive, inachievably expensive licensing. So that was sort of a sad day for all the, tweet bots and Twitterifics and all that.
Well, it's a definite path to success by making your service less accessible to people.
Yeah.
It's definitely what you want to do.
Don't know what they were, I'm not... There's a lot of unhappiness with Twitter. There are various other sort of structural problems with Twitter as well. But there was at least a pretty strong bump in the signups to Mastodon, which is a sort of open source, decentralized Twitter-like place. And it's pretty weird. I've sort of established a couple of identities on Mastodon, but it's decentralized because it has there's a bunch of different independent little community servers that talk to each other in a kind of FidoNet way. So you establish yourself on a server, but you can participate in the larger network. But you still address people at their own servers, which I'm still kind of getting the hang of. But it is kind of relevant here, both because there's Twitter, whatever. We don't have an RCR Mastodon entity, I don't think, at this point, but it does have that same kind of interconnected BBS's feel to it. It's a sort of a retro thing, but I don't really know if they're going to take over the Twitter audience. I suspect not. Though there was a brief moment when Mastodon surged pretty seriously, when all the Twitter clients broke because Twitter turned them off. Anyway, right. So that's as close to retro as that gets, I guess. But
yeah, I've had a Mastodon account for a few months. I haven't really used it much, but I did think it was interesting, just like you said, the FidoNet-like way that it seems to work, which I noticed also. It's like, okay, you have these... I'm talking to my own little server that I've joined up to, but I can get messages that other people send from other servers that sort of propagate around somehow. It's interesting.
Mm-hmm. It's really hard to figure out though where to establish yourself, and also, on Twitter you sort of have an account, or you might have several different personas or whatever. Yeah. But it seems like it's practically the norm to have 15 or something, and each little community is supposed to have some sort of character, but there are so many communities and nobody knows any of them that it's really kind of hard to figure out where to. Sort of plant your flag or whatever. So anyway, we'll see how it goes. I'm kind of curious about it, but not enough to spend a lot of time on it.
Right. Yeah. That's basically how I feel. It's just sort of like, yeah, it's there. Looks interesting. No, I don't have time to find out what it's all about.
Yeah.
Well, folks, I think we've finally come to the close. So that's it for this show. You'll find all our notes for the show at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us in the forums at vcfed.org. You can follow us on Twitter at rcrpodcast, but not on Mastodon. Join our Facebook group, that's rcrpodcast. And you can always send us feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. So if you've got some thoughts about collecting printers, let us know. We're also a member of the Throwback Network, so that's throwbacknetwork.net. So you can find other interesting retro podcasts out there. And of course, please write us a review on iTunes to help other people find this wonderful little show. So everybody, until next time,
Retro Compute!